Hello, this is Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel, and today we're going to be talking about renewable energy, the business of renewable energy. You know that the business model involving energy has been the same since liquid petroleum took over for whale oil, and we may be about to change and go into a different business model, and it could happen rather suddenly and abruptly. My guest today, Chris Rose, is convinced that the United States is kind of getting behind, and we need to get with the program. This is Talk of Alaska.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Alaska Communications System, serving Alaskans across the state with vital telecommunications since before statehood. ACS, providing voice and high-speed broadband solutions, connects Alaska to the rest of the world. Sooner or later, the H1N1 swine flu will come to Alaska. There are simple ways to avoid catching or spreading this or any virus. Wash your hands often with soap and water or use a waterless hand cleaner. Cough into your sleeve or into a tissue rather than your hands. Stay at home if you're sick and contact your health care provider. More information is available on the state website at pandemicflu.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the state of Alaska.
Well, so long as we're putting out websites and phone numbers and so forth, remember that our email address is talk@aprn.org. The telephone number, 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. It's a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. As you can tell, we've been having a few technical problems. I'm hoping that we have them ironed out, and we're going to do the best we can with what we got. With me is, as he has been before, Chris Rose, Executive Director, Renewable Energy Alaska Project. Chris, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thank you, Steve.
You are putting on a workshop. How's it going?
Well, yeah, we're putting on a conference on Monday and Tuesday, May 18th and 19th, called The Business of Clean Energy in Alaska, Bringing the Last Frontier to the Cutting Edge. And the whole idea behind the conference is to bring people from around the country and from other states who have already begun to really see the advantages of promoting energy efficiency and renewable energy as part of the economy. Let them give us some lessons about how they've done that so that we can do the same thing here in Alaska, because we've got a huge opportunity to do so. So the conference is 2 days, 8 panels. We'll have a keynote speaker, Hunter Levins, on Monday night. And it is open to the public. You have to register because the meals are included in the conference. But we're also going to have a free job fair and exhibit hall outside of the panel discussions, and it's at the Denina Center, the brand new convention center downtown.
Yeah, well, that's a fun location.
Yeah, I've only been there a few times since it opened in October, but it is a beautiful location with lots of space and nice views for the people who are coming up from out of state.
So, what kind of interest are you finding in this here? I mean, you've been ceaselessly promoting this for, what, 4 or 5 years now?
Just even a little bit longer. The interest is growing, I would say, exponentially. We already have several legislators registered for the conference. We have business people who are registered. There's a lot of activity going on all around the world, in the United States and now in Alaska. There's a lot of interest in finding the right kind of policies in Alaska that'll promote our energy efficiency and renewable energy businesses up here. And there's more and more people from all ends of this political spectrum who see that this is an economic issue. This is not just an issue about reducing carbon emissions, although that's an important aspect to it. This is really about stabilizing our electric and heating rates so that we are an attractive place to invest.
I didn't get a chance to look at the price of crude oil, but I have a hunch that it's hit $60 today.
That's what I heard this morning.
So we're, and I have a feeling that this time it's not going to like bloat up and go back down. It's kind of absorbed all the economic bad news that it's likely to absorb for a while. I may be wrong in that.
No, I tend to agree. This is a supply and demand issue, and you've got places like India and China that are growing so quickly. 1,000 new cars on the road every day in Mumbai. Everybody who's a middle-class person in India wants to live the same way we live here. China is growing very, very quickly. So it's a supply and demand issue, and we're definitely going to see the price of oil going back up. And even with the low oil prices, the renewable energy industry has survived the last 8-9 months and is continuing on. I was in Chicago last week at the American Wind Energy Association annual wind conference. 23,000 people. Last year, there were 13,000 in Houston. So this is this is a sector, the wind energy sector, that's growing exponentially.
Well, I know a lot of people here are excited about Bernie Carl's work with heat pumps and geothermal, and now he's saying that just the raw energy that exists in the pressure of oil under the ground is enough to generate heat that can generate power.
Yeah, Bernie's been a real pioneer in using low-temperature geothermal, the 165-degree water. He's got a Pacina, is the lowest temperature in the world generating electricity. And as you say, he's pointed out that there are literally thousands of wells in places like Texas that are generating hot fluid, whether it be water or oil, that could be used to generate electricity on the side. So he's been doing an amazing job of promoting that technology.
It seems like it's got to come to choices about where to put the investment. And this could be difficult. I know when the Denali Commission, as an experiment, just opened it up to proposals, they got like, 100 times as much proposals as they had funding for.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, you know, almost every rural community in Alaska, probably every rural community in Alaska is interested in getting off diesel as much as they can.
Oh, absolutely. And we've got communities like Fairbanks now who are interested in doing something too, because their prices have gone up so quickly. What we've got here in Alaska is an opportunity to develop systems for our small villages that we can export around the world. There are now 2 billion people on the planet with no electricity, and many of them live in places like rural Alaska. So we've got a laboratory out there, whether we know it or not, and we can actually demonstrate technology that would be way too expensive to demonstrate in the lower 48, save people money at the same time up here, and perfect that technology that we can use to diversify our economy.
Now I'm starting to get it. You're saying there are business opportunities here.
There's amazing business opportunities, and not just with renewable energy, but also with energy efficiency. The greatest return on investment is with energy efficiency. The biggest bang for your buck, it's the low-hanging fruit. We've got a very inefficient housing stock here in Alaska. There are many, many business opportunities for people just to be going out and doing energy audits and weatherizing homes. And you saw what the demand was when the state of Alaska put over $300 million into weatherization rebates last year. Huge waiting lists. There's a lot of opportunity here. And those are all jobs that people can get into with relatively little training. So there's a lot of job opportunities in places in lower 48. We're seeing foreign companies now coming to states and investing in $300 and $400 million factories to make things like wind turbines. There's no reason why we couldn't be attracting investment like that here in Alaska.
Well, what's holding us up?
Well, when it comes down to it, it really boils down to policy. The states that have really gotten a lot of economic activity into their state have been the states that have reached out with incentives for companies to come in. I actually got an opportunity to meet Governor Culver from Iowa briefly last week in Chicago. He has personally been going around the states and around the world inviting people into Iowa. And now Iowa has, just in the last 5 or 6 years, gotten 9 new manufacturing facilities for wind-related manufacturing facilities in that state. This is a relatively small state in the middle of the country. Most people don't realize that they're a world leader now in renewable energy, but it's because of the policies that they've developed.
Wow. So I'm trying to picture Governor Palin doing that.
Well, I think she's learning that there are lots of opportunities here in Alaska, and I'm hoping that she'll go out and start being the same kind of ambassador that Governor Culver has been. He has really brought a ton of economic activity to his state. To give you some idea of relatively where Iowa's at, for instance, right now 20% of all electricity in Denmark comes from wind. They're the world leaders. And then we've got Portugal and Spain a little bit behind them at 13 and 9%. Iowa now is leading the United States. Almost 8% of all the electricity in Iowa now is from wind. That's a hedge against all fossil fuel prices going up. It means that Iowa is an attractive place because if you want to invest there, you have a better idea of how stable the energy rates are going to be. And because they have set standards for how much energy has to be renewable in that state, they've attracted manufacturing and created a ton of jobs at a time when people are losing their job.
I'm wondering, you know, we've seen that the Alaska legislature now willing to put money into the Renewable Energy Fund. We have seen the election of a Congress that and a president that is serious about at least cap and trade, some kind of capping of carbon emissions. I would think if I was in any kind of energy business, I would be trying to plan ahead for the days when there is going to be more of a carbon economy. Do you see this entering into business plans? I mean, we saw, for instance, BP kind of greenwashing itself. But I think they pulled back from that.
Well, I think you've hit the nail on the head when you're talking about certainty and what the business plan is going to be. Because unless and until there is a stable federal and or state policy, businesses are not going to be able to plan into the future. And the reason why manufacturing and other incentives that are creating jobs in other states are working is because those states have established a policy that has some certainty so that the businesses can come in and know that for the next 5, 10, 20 years, nothing's going to change. The reason why Europe is so far ahead of the United States is because they typically have 20-year policy horizons. So it provides the certainty to somebody who has a $500 million investment that they want to make. They're going to make it in a place where they know the rules are not going to change. That's the same thing we've been saying with the oil companies talking about the gas pipeline. They want to have 20 and 30 year policy horizons. Alaska doesn't have that yet. We don't have a policy horizon that makes it certain that in 20 years, we're going to have the same incentives that we have today. And in fact, the federal government doesn't have that either. The production tax credit, which has been the primary federal policy driving renewable energy, has been authorized by Congress a year or two at a time. And everybody is saying we have to have about a 10-year production tax credit. A lot of people are also talking about a renewable energy standard at the federal level. And there are several bills in Congress right now that would create a standard that would create a mandate of certain percentage of renewable energy across the board in every state in the country, not just the 28 states that have state policy.
A federal mandate.
That's right. It's called a renewable electricity standard. And like I said, there are several bills in Congress right now that are considering that.
Well, what I'm seeing is with there's a lot of slippage right now, I guess you would say. In terms of carbon trading, we're seeing in Europe where there are unintended consequences frequently. There are companies which know how to play the game, as it were. We've seen biofuels result in deforestation. It seems that sometimes when the government chooses to get involved, the results are not always pretty and we get unintended consequences.
Well, there's always unintended consequences. There's unintended consequences of the government not being involved as well. And we've certainly seen those. In Copenhagen in December, the world will be looking at carbon policy again. Most people believe, as you said, that there's going to be some kind of carbon policy in the United States. That will be an overlay over all these other policies that we're talking about. It'll put a price on carbon. Whether that's through a cap and trade policy or whether it's through a tax. I think most people are favoring a cap and trade because that actually will reduce the emissions rather than just forcing people to pay more for using carbon. And you're right. In Europe, they didn't get it right the first time, but they're now going back and figuring out what they did wrong. And I think the United States can learn from what Kyoto, the flaws in the original Kyoto protocol that the Europeans put together.
I am hearing that in the Alps, I think it's in Austria, that they have they've found a way of generating power from their biomass.
Well, we've been generating power from biomass since we started burning.
I have a wood stove in my house. Yeah.
Burning wood in caves. there's a lot of technology breakthroughs that can still happen. And again, until and unless we have policy that's going to incent people taking risks and putting themselves out there, we're not going to have the kinds of quick breakthroughs that we'd like to see. But there's certainly a lot of companies that are putting money into investing in what we all know is in the inevitable. I mean, whether or not you agree that oil is going to run out in 50 years or 100 years or whatever, it's going to run out. So as a society, we have to start looking at what's the next option. And you can't just wait until the time it has run out to figure it out, because we need oil to make wind turbines. We need oil to make solar panels and to make hybrid electric cars. We have to be able to start transitioning now. Most experts think we should have started transitioning 30 years ago when oil was really cheap. But we have to start making that transition. We have to start turning the tanker, if you will.
Our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255. The voice you're hearing is Chris Rose. He's executive director of the Renewable Energy Alaska Project, and they're doing a a conference called The Business of Clean Energy. And you say this is going to involve, this is in Anchorage, it's at the Dedina Center, it's early next week. And this is also going to involve some kind of a trade show. There's actually going to be stuff on display people can go see.
That's right. We'll have, I think, 20 exhibitors have signed up. So they'll be talking about the kinds of renewable energy, energy efficiency programs that they already have, the businesses that they're doing. And we'll also have several of them actually recruiting. This is a job fair. This is the first year of this conference, and we're hoping that in future years, this will grow into something that people can come to and learn about employment opportunities.
Yeah, but for a person hoping to have, maybe a person with an idea, you know, that is hoping to find investment capital, is this the meeting where they're going to be able to do this?
Well, there are a couple of folks from California who are venture capitalists who will be at this meeting, who will be either speaking or moderating. So there'll be a way for people who are at the conference to network with those kinds of people and to learn about how investments are being made. We're not going to have, you know, thousands of people like that, mm-hmm. like there were in Chicago last week at the WIND conference. But certainly for Alaska, this is the first time I think we've brought experts in the renewable energy efficiency field together like this in the state. So it's a unique and initial opportunity for people in Alaska to start meeting people from around the country who have kind of gone through some of these processes over the last 10 years, learn some lessons, and can teach us how we can move forward.
Well, we've got to start someplace. Let's go with the phone calls. Here's Steve in Wasilla. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Steve.
Hi, how you doing?
Oh, just terrific. I mean, how can you not be terrific this time of year in Alaska?
Yeah, it's been great. And I've been enjoying your country music show over on the other station. It's pretty good.
All right.
But what I wanted to advocate is for the Anchorage Bowl would be nuclear power with electric cars, and I think you know, you could basically have almost a completely clean energy source that would drive your heat pumps and also provide you with transportation, you know, energy.
So electric cars, setting the nuclear aside for a second. Electric cars, as I understand it, the problem is range, is it not? They're great for a city runabout or something like that where you can get to a recharging station.
Slow to charge. I mean, once I think it's like 120 miles. Once you drive them 120 miles, your battery's pretty much discharged.
Yeah.
And then it's very slow to recharge it. It takes a couple hours or something.
Yeah.
But I understand that, I guess at MIT, they've done some really good physics, and they've got some breakthroughs where they can charge a battery really quick, and also it'll have a very high discharge rate, so you can get a lot of power out of it very quickly. So, you know, maybe that technology breakthrough is going
to
happen.
Okay, now let's go back to the nuclear part. Why nuclear?
Well, nuclear doesn't emit any greenhouse gases. I mean, it's it doesn't have some of the drawbacks that renewables have that are dependent on wind and sun. And, you know, renewables tend to be and it's a centralized technology. So you have a central station with a small operating staff, and it has all the conveniences of the current electrical grid where, you know, it would go to people's houses and it would drive their heat pumps and, you know, it would charge their cars and their garages. You know, I mean, I'm all for all the renewables too, but I just think that they've done a lot of studies over the years, and you know, the problem with a lot of the renewables is that, you know, you can have the wind stop over large areas and you're not generating any, and you can't store the electricity. Or, you know, up here in Alaska we have, you know, the long dark winters, so you know, the solar doesn't work in the winter. So for the Anchorage Bowl, if you really want to eliminate the greenhouse gases, and all the global warming research is starting to show that, you know, it's really a serious problem. I mean, Lord Stern in England, he's like the number one consultant for the British government. He said that it's starting to look like it's going to be so bad in 100 years that the population carrying capacity of the Earth could drop from 10 billion people in 2050 to 1 billion people sometime early in the next century.
Whoa, yeah. Well, you're kind of preaching to the choir on that one. Chris Rose, also, Steve, let me get, where would you locate it? You got an idea where to put the centralized nuclear generation facility?
I'll admit it's a problem here because of our earthquake potential, you know. But, that's a technology problem. It can, it could be put, across, I'm sure they can design different plants. I mean, it's been a very safe technology. I mean, we had, the China syndrome, the meltdown at Three Mile Island. There was no fatalities from that. So in that, 30 or 40 years
that's a subject. Epidemiology on that is still questionable, I would say. Hey, Chris Rose, you want to respond to that?
Well, I agree that we have to have carbon-free power, and we have to start looking at transportation just as much as we've been looking at heat and electricity. And a lot of people in Alaska are talking about these large hydro projects that are under consideration as the source for charging electric and electric hybrid vehicles. There is no doubt that the technology in electric hybrid vehicles and electric vehicles is improving very, very quickly. We are going to see commercial plug-in hybrids probably in the next 12 to 15 months here in the United States, which means that we can start using our renewable resources to start charging those cars. If you think about it, how much money could we save here in Alaska if we were using our renewable resources to generate electricity to replace the gasoline that we're buying? I mean, we're spending hundreds of millions of dollars on gasoline here in the state and exporting those dollars rather than keeping them in the state and recirculating them. We also have places like Sitka, for instance, with 12 miles of road and tons of hydropower that could be a demonstration place where we can actually show that, hey, a whole city can go electric car. You don't need to have a big, powerful vehicle when you're in Sitka with 12 miles of road.
Yeah, isn't, and Stedman's a big pusher on this, isn't he?
Well, I think he definitely supports more renewable energy. And, we're talking about Lake Chocachamna, 330 megawatt hydro project, and the Susitna project, more than a gigawatt of electric power. If we build those projects, there's definitely an opportunity for us to start saying, hey, we're gonna cut off some of that power and we're going to put it over toward transportation and we're going to keep dollars that we would have spent on gasoline in the state.
Stephen Wasilla, thanks for your call.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Okay. We're going to look a little bit more into liquid fuels here in the second half of the program, but now let's jump into some more of these callers here. Jim in... To Fred in Barrow. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Fred.
Hey, thank you very much. I just wanted to point out, we've been developing oil and gas up here on the North Slope for over 30 years. We've been providing gas and oil to the economy in the lower 48, to the rest of the world. And, it continues today. We still have a lot of gas that needs to be pumped out. And, we have a lot of coal beds in the foothills of the Brooks Range. And, I look forward to working with our native people here on the North Slope and getting this stuff to market and bringing our economy back to where it was before it crashed. And, there is a lot of opportunity here. There's opportunities for mass jobs for people that, are just home, not doing anything, that got laid off or the job ended. All we have to do is believe again in the state of Alaska, what runs this state and the opportunities that we have with oil and gas, minerals, coal beds, and, I just wanted to commend your host there and your speakers on, alternative resources that can be tapped into as well.
All right, Fred. Yeah, there's no question. There's massive coal deposits there, and we keep looking for a way of getting enough investment to get a gas line in. Boy, everybody wants that. So thank you.
Yes, definitely. And
yes.
Thank you very much. You guys have a good morning over there.
We are indeed. It's beautiful today. What's it like up there in Barrow, weather-wise?
It's cloudy right now. We got about 20 above. Winds out of the south. We got no ocean out there. It's all covered with ice.
Oh.
And, you know, they talk about global warming, and, you know, they say there's not enough ice out there, but there's so much ice out there that we can't even go bowhead whaling.
Do you have the buntings in, the birds yet?
Yes, we got them. They're coming in flocks. It's amazing. And, you know, it's coming alive again in this part of the world. We have, as far as development's been going on in the last 30 years, we still have animals, birds, we have quails, seals, polar bears. We have it all up here, you know. And, you know, it just worries me that, you know, when environmentalists make sensationalist remarks about global warming and stuff, you know, it's just offends my sensitivity.
Thank you, Fred.
Hey, thank you very much.
Great to hear from the North Slope. It's Talk of Alaska. We're talking about the business of clean energy. And they do have lots of fossil resources up there on the North Slope.
Well, there's no doubt fossil resources have built Alaska's economy. But those fossil resources, like I said before, will run out. And we can all argue about when it's going to be, how long. The point is we have to kind of look ahead and start building another economy. Because, for instance, we're 90% reliant. Our whole state is reliant on those oil royalties. And we all know that production is going down. So even if we get a gas line, we might have royalties for another 30, 40 years.
Yeah, gas plays out quicker than oil.
Right. I mean, and that might be a lot in the terms of a human life, but in terms of a society, don't we want to be around 200, 300, 500 years from now? We have to start looking at how to diversify our economy. And the thing about renewable energy is it's inexhaustible. And so once we start investing in these resources like wind, geothermal, and so on, we can be sure that those resources will be there in 500 years, and all we have to do is keep adapting the technology and making it more efficient. So it is a very sustainable way to not only produce energy but have an economy.
Jim joins the program from Eagle River. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Jim.
Thank you. Yes, I've been thinking about this issue, and it seems that wind turbines are industry which is taking off, and world energy supply might be expected to be 30% from wind where in 30 years, where today it's less than 1%. So, you know, it's early enough that we could get on the production bandwagon and build wind turbine production facilities here. We could lock in a market by making a deal with China, for instance, to sell our gas 7% below market if they'll spend 20% of the market price on wind turbines manufactured here. In 20 years, they'd have turbines to replace the energy stream.
Where would you put the plant, Jim?
There might be several plants. Most of the workers are in the Anchorage-Mattsu area, so that would be an area. Although you might not need a lot of workers, you could put the plant anywhere it's convenient, I suppose.
Yeah. Just hang on a second here. Chris, you were just at a wind energy conference.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't there quite a lot of talk of retooling, maybe like, for instance, the automotive industry and some of the other Rust Belt facilities?
Oh, absolutely. Jennifer Granholm, the governor of Michigan, was at the conference talking about that exact thing. There are many, many places in the upper Midwest and Mideast that have been building cars and other heavy equipment for a long time. Those industries are going by the wayside, but those factories are being remodeled for just what we're talking about, building wind turbines, building towers, and so on. The biggest wind tower facility in the world is going to be built soon in Colorado. And so there's no doubt that especially those places that have seen a lot of job loss are looking at retooling for the future. 42% of all new electric generation capacity in the whole United States last year was wind.
Well, do you think there's a place for Alaska in the fabrication, the manufacturing of these facilities?
Well, absolutely, because what we have here is a niche market for smaller turbines.
Mm-hmm.
We've got the 100 kilowatt, 200 kilowatt, 500 kilowatt turbine market here in Alaska for these small villages.
And even now, they're measuring wind potential all over the state.
Oh, yeah. We've got an amazing wind potential, but we've also got smaller communities. And the niche is those 2 billion people in the world that live in small communities that don't need the 2-megawatt machines. There's only 3 or 4 companies in the whole world now making the 500 kilowatt machines and smaller.
Oh.
So we could definitely be attracting one or more of those companies to Alaska to build turbines, not only for ourselves, but then for export.
It looks like you're onto something there, Jim.
Yeah, well, thank you. And I'd just like to add that nuclear is not emission-free. They use a lot of concrete in those nuclear power plants, and that is a high pollution cost in making concrete and a lot of carbon emissions. And for people to say that nuclear is emission-free is a plain... It's just not true. Plus, you're producing very dangerous waste products that can be used for nuclear weapons.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's actually a huge subject that I think, Jim, I want to just take it off the table because I don't want to go down that rabbit trail. We can go forever with that. But, Jim, thank you so much for your call on Avigo River. It is Talk of Alaska. We're talking about the business of renewable energy, of clean energy. Chris Rose is our guest as Talk of Alaska continues. All right, and here we are. Let's go ahead and bring in our next guest here, who is Jim Lane, the editor and publisher of Biofuels Digest. He joins us by telephone. Jim, how you doing?
Not too bad, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Well, no, it's a pleasure having you. You're about the most qualified person I can think of to comment on this new thrust from Energy Secretary Chu and the entire, really, Obama administration to... get serious, I guess you would say, about biofuels. It seems like Congress sort of misfired the last time and drove the price of food up because it turned out that corn was your big source of ethanol, and the farmers made their investment decisions very quickly when Congress changed the incentive structure. This time around, they're saying, no, it's got to be cellulosic, and they've set deadlines. What do you think of they seem like very conservative deadlines to me. Do they seem realistic to you?
Sure, they do. The deadlines have been made fuel neutral, which helps a lot because it's no longer prescriptive about we have to have so much corn ethanol, we have to have so much biodiesel made from soy. So it's going to be a lot easier for all of us to meet those targets. But it's 36 billion gallons, which sounds like an awful lot, but we've got 13 years to get there. So that's a fairly stable ramp up. It's about similar to the growth that we've been experiencing in the industry to date.
Wow. So that's rational. Do you think that this we've been talking a lot about investment climate and planning horizons that can go out to policy horizons go out 20 years? Do you think this goes out far enough to spur the investment into scaling this technology up to where we're going to get the big digesters and the whatever kind of biochemistry we're really going to need for converting massive amounts of cellulosic material into fuels?
I think that the legislation and the policy directives that we've seen over the last couple of months have given a lot of encouragement to the investment sector that there's going to be a stable public policy, increasingly stable in terms of how to address, if not climate change, certainly how to address energy independence and the creation of alternative fuels and of alternative types of energies. And that's really welcome because that sort of, today it's very different, tomorrow it'll be different again. It's very difficult for the investment sector to absorb, and so that sort of drives up the need for the government to fund everything. So if we have stable policy from government, it'll be a lot less expensive for the taxpayer because the investment sector will pick up the slack. And I think that's what we're going to see, although, of course, this year is a all-time difficult year to finance renewable energy as well as everything else. But that should ease, and it is already easing, and the government is helping by getting some short-term financing on the street. There was a lot of money tied up in the farm bill that had already been passed. It just hadn't hit the street, and the president directed Secretary Vilsack at USDA to get that on the street in 30 days. So that's going to help a lot in terms of easing distress and getting us set on a very exciting future.
All right. We're talking to Jim Lane of Biofuels Digest as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Also with us is Chris Rose of the Renewable Energy Alaska Project. They're doing a a conference, the Business of Clean Energy in Alaska, probably the first time to bring together renewable energy businesses in Alaska, and I guess kind of see what happens. Chris, what do you see as a future for biofuels in Alaska?
Well, we certainly have some opportunity with the fish oil plants, the fish processors already using.
They're gung-ho. Yeah, I mean, they're ready to jump into it.
Right. I mean, that's a pretty small market. There's probably 13 million gallons of fish oil that's currently being thrown into the ocean in the form of unprocessed waste that we should be catching and using. We do have a lot of areas around the state where we are growing willows naturally that potentially could be made into things like ethanol when we are able to perfect cellulosic ethanol.
Yeah. A lot of it, Terry Chapin was going into this at that scientific conference yesterday and pointing out that there are many villages in the boreal forest where it could be because, I mean, as we know, the climate pattern has changed to the extent that there's a lot of beetle kill, and the boreal forest is actually drying out. Mm-hmm. Some permafrost is melting, and trees are dying. And he's suggesting that maybe it's time for some active management, and that they can get a shorter replacement cycle for some of the things, but it's likely to be used to burn.
Well, that's what they're doing right now. There are many, many villages that are and communities that are already using wood biomass for district heating, and there are more and more of those already. Several of those communities recently got grants through the Renewable Energy Grant Program. The next step will probably be some kind of gasification of wood to make electricity and or possibly some kind of liquid fuel production.
Yeah. So let's go to the national side of it. Jim Lane, I asked you briefly yesterday, do you see potential for this in Alaska? And you said, oh, big time. We got aviation and the need for liquid fuels here.
Well, sure. There's sort of an upstream impact, which I think Chris has really addressed very well in terms of some of the wood waste opportunities as well as fish oil. On the national front, there's a lot more progress that has been made over the last 3 or 4 months on conversion of wood waste into cellulosic ethanol. It's getting quite close to parity in terms of its pricing.
Wow.
And in fact, a lot of plants are really just trying to get finance at this point. They've really proven out their technology. Companies like Blue Fire Ethanol and Zeachem are just chomping at the bit to get access to the agricultural and forest residues. And the key word here is residue. We're really moving from converting things that are needed for other uses to converting things that are left over. So that's kind of on the upstream side. On the downstream side, Alaska's got a lot to benefit from renewable transport fuels because of all the work that's being done in the area of Jet A. And there's a lot of Jet A that's used in Alaska, probably more so as a percentage than any other place in the nation.
Yes.
In terms of fuel, because it has a wonderful low freezing point. That makes it much more superior to diesel. So it's not just used in jets, it's used for off-road and road use as well. And there's been a tremendous amount of work in making renewable fuels, Jet A, from renewable sources. So it's made from biomass, but it operates exactly the same as your current jet fuel. It's called a drop-in fuel, and that's going to be good for all users. It has a very low sulfur content, so it solves a sort of ultra-low sulfur diesel problem that has been difficult. And also it gives us an alternative source, and that's really good. There's been some test flights, Japan Airlines, Continental, Virgin Atlantic, and others have tested successfully, and they say that we're going to have UOP Honeywell. It says that they are going to be licensing their technology this year to start making jet fuel from biomass, and that's a good sort of downstream impact for the end user.
I have heard from generally from biofuels that there can be unforeseen fouling problems in the gear. People taking traditional gear that burns a liquid petroleum-based fuel and going to a biofuel and discovering it fouls quicker.
Well, that's actually part of what the government has done in sort of readdressing our attention onto biofuels and making it more fuel neutral instead of being specific about ethanol. Most of those problems have been experienced with ethanol, which is corrosive. For instance, if you are a small boat operator and you have an old-fashioned tank that's made of fiberglass, well, ethanol does not react well with fiberglass. So there are some incidents, and you do also have to watch out if you're using a lot of ethanol in your pipes, because it's hygroscopic. It actually absorbs water. So if you have a lot of water in your tank or in your pipes, you just have to be more attentive about the use of the fuel. And that's inconvenient for some people, but better to use our brain power than to use our fossil power. Sure.
Yeah. Why? You would probably be a great speaker for Chris's conference that's happening next week. Chris, you got any questions here for Jim Lane?
Well, Jim, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the drop-in fuel. One of the concerns that I think a lot of Alaskans have is our huge dependence on, for instance, our food coming in from outside. 95% of all our food comes from elsewhere, at an average of about 5,000 miles away. And so we have a huge interest, I think, in this state in keeping the aviation industry healthy. And I just heard a report today on NPR about how even though the price of fuel is going down, airlines are still losing money. So I'm wondering if you have kind of an analysis on how this drop in fuel might help us keep the airlines alive.
Well, the airlines are pretty worried, and things are coming at them from other parts of the world, too. For instance, in Europe, they're starting what's called the Emissions Trading Scheme. It's been around for a long time. It's just not applied to the aviation sector. It will starting in 2012, and that will add $10 billion a year to the expense of running airlines. So their attention on getting carbon neutral and carbon negative fuels is just at an all-time high. But we have seen four successful tests where they've operated algae-based biofuel, also from camelina, which is grown in conjunction with wheat, also Jatropha, which is grown in South Asia, have all been tested successfully. And what's really good news about that was unexpected is not only did we get the renewable energy, reduction in emissions, and obviously it's an alternative supply and we can grow it at home, so it's got, not as far to travel, but also we got better mileage. So it actually reduces the cost of transport. And it's only about 4% gain, but that was a wholly unexpected and nice advance. And Boeing is saying that they expect to have biofuels used in commercial aviation by 2012 or 2013. And, for some of those feedstocks, and all those feedstocks will be active by later in the decade. So that's good news for the cost of operation, and also for those that are worried about carbon emissions.
We're talking with Jim Lane of Biofuels Digest. Jim, if a person wanted to get a hold of your publication, how would they do it? I haven't seen it on my newsstand.
Well, they go to biofuelsdigest.com. It's an online newsletter. It's available. It comes out 9 o'clock Eastern time daily, and then it's available thereafter on the web in sort of an expanded version. So that's how you look for it.
This must be exciting for you to be involved in this, because it looks as if this industry has really just been beginning to take off.
Sure, it is an exciting time as the grandson of a farmer and also an oil man on the other side, to be able to work in both those areas in agri-energy is pretty darn exciting to see all these things coming together at this time. But it is an exciting time and not just on the policy side, but really on the technology side, because what's coming out of the labs right now, where we're able to increase our yields from where we can make more fuels from residues than we were 5 years ago by using things like corn that are used elsewhere in the food supply and in the feed supply. So we really can feed and fuel the world now. We have a lot more options on the table. So it is pretty darn exciting to report on.
If you can stay with us for a second, Jim, I'd like to bring a phone caller or two in.
Sure.
Okay, let's go to Tom in Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Tom.
Yes. Good morning, gentlemen. It seems apparent to me that for reasons of national security and worldwide environmental stability, we need to have government-imposed policy that the private sector is not factoring into its cost structure. And some of these, and particularly we have to go to, because of the environmental issue of carbon, we have to go to non-carbon sources or reduced carbon sources minimally. And to do that, you have to go where the power is available in large quantities, distributed energy while a very interesting and supplemental power source is probably not going to meet our near-term or long-term energy needs.
So where are you going with this? So setting a dam or wire?
Well, yeah, we have to look at all of the... Well, first of all, you have to, you know, grasp and deal with the question of whether we should have government dictating energy policy instead of the market. And, you know, the governor is doing that in part by consolidating the utilities along the rail belt.
Well, if she manages to pull it off, so far she hasn't.
Right, and that's part of the policy, but it has to be done on a national level. But that's the general idea, is that we have to get the energy producers coordinated in following a specific set of energy policies.
Yeah.
You know, that's one indication of where that would go, is consolidation of utility.
All right, Tom, I want to thank you for your call, and we'll get a little ways with it, is what I can say, I guess, at this point.
I've got, questions about biofuels, too.
Okay, well, first, let me go to Chris, just on this issue of... Do you favor the governor's idea of consolidating the power generation, the what they used to call the G&T, where instead of having these co-ops that come out of the old REA model, like antique electric utilities, fossil electric utilities from the 30s and 50s still existing here in Alaska with all their separate boards of directors all trying to figure out where to put their next power plants, and maybe it should just be one entity that figures it out?
Well, if we combined all six rail belt utilities from Homer up to Fairbanks, it would equal one moderately sized utility in the lower 48.
So, yes.
So certainly we're not getting the economies of scale that we would get with some kind of combined effort, nor are we getting the mandated integrated planning that we have to have so that all those utilities that are now on a integrated transmission system are working together. That's not to say that they're not working together already. I mean, we actually do have quite a seamless operation of this transmission grid, but I think what...
It always seems to be one outlier.
Well, that actually...
It's either Golden Valley or it's MEA. You know that.
Well, I think that all these utilities have been around for, 50, 60 years, and I think it's natural for them to protect their interests. And I think the main issue that I've been hearing regarding the plan to consolidate these utilities is figuring out the details now, because I think a lot of utilities legitimately are concerned about how are the details really going to affect me, because I think what they're being asked to do right now is just sign up and then we'll figure out the details later, and they're protecting their interests and saying how are we going to do that. But I think generally everybody in the rail belt agrees that we would benefit from having some kind of consolidation of at least the planning for generation and transmission, and the utilities could continue to be distribution utilities and interface with the local customers.
Wow. Yeah, Tom, that's probably as far as we're going to get with this, but we'll keep you on the line. And Jim Lane, if I can keep you on the line, we'll come back once again to biofuels as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
It's Talk of Alaska. We're talking about the business of clean energy in Alaska. There's a whole lot changing in the renewable energy field. The incentives are changing, the government policies are changing, and the climate is changing. And there's just plenty to talk about. Upcoming next week is the Business of Clean Energy Conference put on by the Renewable Energy Alaska Project. Chris Rose, the executive director, is here with us. Tom is on the telephone and had a question about biofuels for Jim Lane, editor and publisher of Biofuels Digest. Go ahead, Tom. You have the floor.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, and I'm particularly interested in waste-to-fuels technology. Right now, the military fuel supply division is about to issue an RFP for all of Alaska Jet A to have it produced 50-50 with petroleum diesel. Its total is about 80 million gallons a year.
Fantastic, Tom. Okay, let's take that one to Jim Lane.
Well, I think that waste to fuels is an incredibly important area. There's a national conference actually going on next week in San Diego, which is the where they're all gathering to compare notes on the new technology. And there's a lot of new ways to make it. The good news is there are almost every county or district in the United States really should have and can have a waste to fuels strategy for anything from residues from agriculture, forests, but also municipal solid waste. And that's kind of the cleanest fuel that you can make is the stuff that you're making from trash, and also it's already aggregated, so you don't.
Absolutely no idea. Really?
Yes, you can make it from landfill, and it's actually pretty. The economics are pretty good, and there's a project, Blue Fire Ethanol, which is a company based in California, has a couple of projects, and Agresti. Here in the United States, they're down in Kentucky, and also they're now exporting the technology to Vietnam. So it's going to be an export industry for the U.S. as well.
And I guess you would, in answer to Tom's question, kind of favor this incentive program that the military has sort of been backed into.
Sure. I mean, the military is the largest consumer of diesel fuel in the world, the United States military. So, and I would add that in the forward areas, they pay up to $418 a gallon for delivery of fuel to Iraq, so you can produce fuel for a very high price and still be offering alternative low cost to the military if you can make it where it's needed. And that's the most important thing about bioenergy is that it can be made right where it's used, and that lowers the distribution costs. And that means a lot to the military, so it's a smart thing for them to be looking at.
All right, Jim Lane, I want to thank you for being with us on the program.
Sure. Been a pleasure.
All right. Jim Lane, editor and publisher of Biofuels Digest, giving us plenty to think about. Tom, that was a great set of questions there. I want to go now down to Dillingham, where Gregory joins the program. Gregory, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Buenos dias, Steve.
Buenos dias.
Yes, we are really blessed with lots of fuel up here, but we're missing out on the things that do not pollute the planet. I mean, Alaska is 80% of all the volcanoes here, and Iceland is tapping into that energy where it's non-polluting. And as we speak here in Bristol Bay, we're drilling down. They did some seismic tests and on the Earth's core, and they found some deep fissures, cracks, where in Naknek they're drilling a huge hole down there as we speak, and they're gonna hit the core, and that's pretty clean fuel.
Wow. All right, Gregory, thank you. Chris, you want to say a few words about geothermal, because I know it's coming.
Well, absolutely. For larger scale geothermal, we have an opportunity over Mount Spur, which is probably the closest one for the Anchorage Power Grid, the Rail Belt Grid, and Ormat Technologies, which is one of the leading developers of geothermal energy, paid over $3 million to the state of Alaska last September for the lease rights. And we're hoping that they're going to start an exploration program over there this summer to find out exactly what we have. We don't know.
Well, it's a little dangerous at the moment, isn't it?
No, I don't think. I don't think there's really any danger there. I think it's costly. That's the issue. And this drilling technology, we have a huge benefit of having a lot of drilling.
I don't know,
because
I'd like to land over there with, you know, and with the potential of that dome collapsing any minute.
Well, that's at Redoubt. you know, we're talking about. Talking about Spur.
We got a different volcano.
Although,
thank you.
Although Spur is active, we're not looking at. You know, they're not looking at planting any kind of a power plant right on the volcano, but we want to see what's over there. They got to figure out what the quantity and the temperature of the water is. But that could be a huge potential because it's not that far from the Beluga power grid that starts over the Beluga power plant there. And also, if we did Lake Chacachamna, it could tie into that same power grid, as could more wind development and tidal energy development that's on the west side of Cook Inlet.
So what kind of planning horizon would we have for actually making some of this happen?
Well, the planning horizon for something at Mount Spur, I understand, is in the neighborhood of 7 years. It's probably going to take a few years of drilling to find out exactly what they've got. And they might be able to expedite that a little bit if they had a really big development they could get.
So I think what you're telling me is you have this kind of interesting potential because you already have the grid going there.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got the turbines, but they are wearing out. And then you've got the potential of a hydro and the potential of a geothermal, and they're all kind of sitting in the same location with the power lines already going to them. But it seems like the timing doesn't quite work out. In other words, some of this generation, some of these turbines are going to need to be replaced or refurbished or something before any of these others could come online.
Well, absolutely. And the utilities are already looking at that. They realize that they probably have to kind of keep going with the gas technology. But unfortunately, we've really got all our eggs in one basket. Hugach Electric's over 90% gas fired. And their contracts with the suppliers run out in a few years.
And if we don't get more gas from someplace, it's all screwed anyway.
Yeah, so the supply of gas and then, of course, the price of that gas when and if
yes.
we get it is a huge issue. We are in a predicament here in the rail belt. We have to figure out what we're going to be doing much sooner because a lot of these projects that we're talking about have 5-10 year time horizons on them.
Let's go to Juneau, and Nathan joins the program. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Nathan. Just got a couple minutes.
Okay, good morning, Steve. Thank you. I work for a company. I'm a forester down in Juneau, and we've been looking at converting our building, which is over a 60,000 square foot building, to run off of wood pellets. And we already talked about this morning on the show unintended consequences. And with wood pellets, if they were available locally, you could get those for about $130 a ton, and off of residues and more efficient logging off the lands. Here in Juneau, you can get wood pellets for about $300 a ton retail. Oh. So we went around and we looked at the major buildings in Juneau, and specifically we looked at the federal building and we looked at the state office building. And those two buildings, when they're running heat, number two diesel, They're using up to 10,000 gallons every other week.
I'm sensing a potential here. So you're talking about trying to get a pellet fabrication plant someplace in Southeast?
Yeah, but you can't do that unless you have the demand. So if you create the demand with the large users of wood heat, then you could do it. And just think of the message you could send to the world and to the renewable energies communities that if the state of Alaska is concerned about its ability to run and heat its buildings and about the future availability of fossil fuels if they were to convert their state office building to run off of some kind of renewable wood heat.
Oh, I love
the federal building were to do the same.
Thank you, Nathan. I love ending the show with the subject of the SOB. Okay, Chris Rose, you got about 30 seconds.
Well, I want to thank you for having me on the show again today, Steve, and mentioning the conference next week. Just want to reiterate that the exhibition hall and the job fair at the Dena'ina Center on Monday and Tuesday is free and open to the public. You have to register and pay to get into the conference on Monday and Tuesday, and you can do that on our website, which is realaska.org. And appreciate the opportunity. Thanks.
Very, very good. Do we already have a pellet plant someplace? I think we do.
They're looking at building one up in the interior, actually.
It's Talk of Alaska. Next week, we'll be talking about electing our attorney general. What a concept. Gooseberry Peter at the controls, Lynn Anderson on the phones, Pat Yak in charge. I'm Steve Heimel. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by BP. Giving back to the community is a priority because so many at BP call Alaska home. And by Alaska Communications Systems, serving Alaskans across the state with vital telecommunications since before statehood. ACS, providing voice and high-speed broadband solutions, connects Alaska to the rest of the world. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.